This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, a program sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Boylston and Bolton, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we will be bringing you news from Berlin, Bolton, Boylston, Clinton, Lancaster, Sterling, and West Boylston. Today, we will be reading from the May 22nd edition of the item. This is Ellen. AdaptX Unified 5K is May 30th. Lancaster. The Unified 5K is an inclusive road race and adaptive sports expo at RFK Community Alliance in Lancaster. It takes place on Saturday, May 30th. The expo opens at 8:30 a.m. The Kids Fun Run is at 9:35 a.m., and the 5K and 1 mile race begin at 10 a.m. at RFK, 971 Main Street. Participants with and without disabilities share a start line and can walk, run, or roll the 1 mile or 5K distance. Younger athletes can join the Railers and Woosocks mascot for a Kids Fun Run. Participants and spectators are able to engage with more than 20 adaptive sports and assistive tech vendors at the Adapt Expo. More than 1 in 4 adults in the U.S. have a disability. Literature demonstrates that people with disabilities aren't as active as their non-disabled peers, but it's not for a lack of interest. 76% report a desire to be active, but face significant barriers to doing so. AdaptX is changing that. Through funds raised at the Unified 5K, AdaptX, founded by Brendan Aylward, will be donating 4 running blades to local amputees and a Hoyt running chair to a local sister duo team. All funds raised through the Unified 5K support programs to create more health and wellness opportunities for individuals with intellectual and physical disabilities. In 2025, AdaptX was able to disseminate more than $29,000 in adaptive equipment in 2025 and has a goal of exceeding $50,000 in grants in 2026. AdaptX is a nonprofit that addresses barriers to better health and fitness for individuals with intellectual and physical disabilities through education, advocacy, accessibility, and scholarship. AdaptX educational programs provide health, fitness, and disability service professionals with the tools and knowledge to create more inclusive fitness programs. AdaptX operates the Rick Hoyt Research Lab, where they explore best practices of adaptive fitness as well as the implementation of inclusive fitness. The organization's Unified 5K series raises awareness and makes fitness accessible in communities around the country while also fundraising for grant and ambassador programs to address socioeconomic barriers to fitness. Learn more about AdaptX at www.adaptx.org and the Unified 5K series at unified5k.org. Kerrigan hopes to return to Clinton Select Board. Candidate announcement. I'm Sean Kerrigan. I've been on your Clinton Select Board since 2017, and I'm asking you to reelect me on June 8th. I'm a journalist by trade, and the first rule of journalism is to show, not tell. We've come a long way together over the past 9 years, and as a result, today Clinton is in the best shape it's seen in a generation. While other people might tell you this isn't true, I'm going to show you why it is. Some people will tell you they're accountable, responsive, and transparent. I'll show you the town Facebook page, with which hundreds interact daily, and which I created. I'll show you my website, KerriganForClinton.org, my email, KerriganForClinton@gmail.com, and my phone number, 617-319-4738. I have nothing to hide, and I'll never hide from you. More important, I'll also show you how a local community access TV station that, thanks to my leadership as a member of the cable committee, now broadcasts every major board meeting on cable and YouTube. That's real transparency, not talk. Some people will tell you they'll practice fiscal responsibility. I'll show you 9 years of balanced budgets, during which time we added nearly $3 million to the town's stabilization fund, with another $500,000 coming this year, and 2 key positions to our administrative team. Used correctly, the assistant town administrator and HR director will strengthen town services and deliver the real results in efficiency others talk about in public but oppose in private. That's how you make sure our community is well managed for generations to come, with smart decisions, brave action, and strategic compromise, not empty promises. But just because things are great today doesn't mean there aren't challenges ahead. In 2023, I said we couldn't turn back to the old ways, however safe they may appear. That temptation might be stronger than ever for some of you now. But nostalgia is not a plan. We need to stay focused, stay united, and keep Clinton headed in the right direction. We're losing a major employer in Jabil. We have a property on Sterling Street that's our next best chance at transformative development. State aid continues to fall short of what towns like Clinton need. These are real problems that need real leadership, not just rhetoric. Lastly, you deserve someone who represents your values. Over the past year, our beautifully diverse community has come under attack. I stood up to ICE and passed a resolution letting the people of Clinton know that everyone who lives here deserves the same liberty and justice we all are supposed to enjoy under the Constitution. That's because if you live here, no matter where you're from or when you moved here, what your accent is like or who you love, you're a Clintonian. I've been showing up for Clintonians like you since 2017, and as long as I'm in office, I'll never stop. I'm Sean Kerrigan, your select board member. Please vote for me on June 8th, and let's keep Clinton moving forward together. Letter to the editor. Recommends officials follow Lancaster Town Meeting on budget. There's an old saying, if you ask your plumber whether you need new pipes, the answer will probably be yes. The same is often true in government. If you ask departments whether they need more funding, the answer is usually yes. It's up to voters to weigh the requests and decide what we want to buy. At annual town meeting, Lancaster voters approved a municipal service budget increase of approximately 5.5%, rather than the 11.6% increase proposed. Residents made a thoughtful decision to support increased spending while setting sustainable limits. I was disappointed when on Monday the select board directed the town administrator to prepare two budgets, one that works within the appropriation approved by voters, another that would require a June special town meeting to seek additional spending. Keeping the door open for more spending virtually guarantees that the budget within the approved appropriation becomes a half-hearted exercise. The board's expectation should have been straightforward. Produce the strongest possible budget within the funding voters authorized. Identify efficiencies, delay lower priorities, reconsider staffing or spending assumptions, make the difficult choices now. At Monday's meeting, discussion of a future override was framed almost as an unavoidable certainty. It is not. Overrides become inevitable only when communities decide difficult adjustments cannot be made. Lancaster still has the opportunity and responsibility to prove otherwise. Town meeting is not merely advisory. It's the legislative body of our government. Residents give up evenings with their families to review warrant articles and ask questions, debate priorities, and cast votes. Those decisions deserve more than acknowledgement. They deserve earnest implementation. Good governance means respecting outcomes, even when they differ from recommendations. The clearest way to honor voters is not to revisit their decision immediately, but to make every reasonable effort to carry it out. Russ Wilston, Lancaster. Clinton finalizes town meeting warrant by Ken Cleveland. On Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m., it's at the Fallon Auditorium at Clinton Town Hall. The warrant for the June 1st annual town meeting has over 36 articles for voters to act on. The select board reviewed the warrant at its May 6th meeting as final language still needed to be completed. Many articles are spending measures with a town budget of $71,193,599, up 2.9% from last year, an article that is needed to proceed with the proposed Newtown Library asks voters to allocate $24,854,052 for the new library, which would be built at 239 Chestnut Street. The article would accept the state library board grant of $11,316,281 and approved borrowing the town's share of $13,537,771. The project also needs to pass at the town election. Other articles include appropriating $400,000 for the cable access account for design and construction of a television studio, $100,000 for school textbooks and technology, $250,000 for payment of special education out-of-district tuition, establishing a special education stabilization fund, and funding it with $500,000 from free cash, putting $500,000 into the stabilization fund, and adding $150,000 to the health insurance trust fund. Other articles would fund police, fire, and DPW contracts retroactively. An article would seek to remove the Clinton Fire Department from the provisions of civil service, rescinding the town's 1914 vote. The change would not affect civil service rights of current members of the fire department. A new fire engine pumper truck is being sought with funding of $1 million. New bleacher units for Fuller Field would require $65,000 funded by voters. $200,000 is sought for townwide HVAC repairs and upgrades. $1 million for road resurfacing and infrastructure improvements needs voters' okay. Other spending could provide $65,000 for new 3/4-ton pickup truck with plow and a $51,000 for a new half-ton pickup with plow for the DPW. An article could allow the select board to acquire easements or other interest connected to the rail trail. Another would allow a private landowner an access easement across town land off South Meadow Road. Another would allow the select board to enter a payment in lieu of taxes agreement with Green Path Pondview Clinton Energy Initiative, LLC, for the solar array off of West Boylston Street. An article would insert an administrative bylaw section related to fire prevention and code enforcement fees. A zoning bylaw amendment would change the definition of a kennel. A possible personnel bylaw for the voters was a placeholder that the select board had not reviewed and eventually withdrew from the warrant. "I don't doubt it's needed, but I'm just looking at this now," select board member Sean Kerrigan said. Though it dates from June of 2025, the board was just getting the revisions that would go before town meeting. "I'm opposed to rushing it through," select board member Bill Conley Jr. said. Having previously served on the personal board, select board member Mary Rose Dickott said the board was at that time looking at personnel bylaw changes for town meeting. "We didn't feel we were ready to go forward with it that year. That could be the reason they haven't brought it forward," Dickott said. Two citizen petitions would also address personnel board and bylaws. One would amend the bylaw so the personnel board would consist of 6 members. 5 voting members would be registered voters of the town appointed by the select board. A 6th member would be a full-time employee of the town, either elected or appointed, serving in a non-voting capacity. Another citizen petition would set dual service restrictions on certain boards. It would prohibit a person from serving on more than one of 3 listed boards, select board, finance committee, and personnel board. The purpose of this section is to promote transparency, avoid conflicts of interest, and ensure the independent operation of the key town boards and committees, the petition states. The meeting will be held June 1st, starting at 7 p.m. in Fallon Auditorium at the Town Hall. Agnes of God reading at First Church on June 6th, Lancaster. City on a Hill Arts will present a staged reading of Agnes of God by John Pimer on Saturday, June 6th at 2 p.m. at the First Church of Lancaster at 725 Main Street. Another performance will be on Friday, June 5th at 7 p.m. at the Ashley Free Public Library at 812 Main Street. Directed by Lorian Corbelletti, the play deals with the tension between faith and science. Summoned to a convent, Dr. Martha Livingston, a court-appointed psychiatrist, is charged with assessing the sanity of a young nun accused of murder. The mother superior tries to keep them apart, arousing suspicion. Livingston's questions force all 3 women to re-examine the measure of faith and the power of love. Director Lorian Corbelletti of Milford, New Hampshire, said she was drawn to this play because it explores the perpetual conflict between faith and science, and wrestles with the concepts of spiritual and mental health, guilt and innocence. As I delved further with the actors, I realized the power of this play lay not in a resolution to the plot-centered murder mystery, but in the myriad of realities and the plurality of possibilities that defy any definitive consensus. It is a play that questions, answers, and celebrates questions. John Pilmer, for me, that is the core of the true dialogue. The cast includes Dash Award winner Avery Columbus of Groton as the title character. Rounding out the cast are Bethany Johnson of Hubbardston and Dr. Livingstone and Debbie Molin of Ashby as Mother Superior. City on a Hill Arts does not charge admission to its shows, seeking to remove economic barriers to live theater. However, reservations are recommended at cityonahillarts.org. Agnes of Gods is presented with support from Mass Humanities, the Ashley Free Public Library, and the Lancaster Cultural Council, which is a division of the Mass Cultural Council. Clinton Advocates for Family Intervention by Jan Gottsman, Clinton. Adults can speak at microphones all they want, but children will always steal the show. The Clinton Early Childhood Resource Center, CECRC, hosted VIPs for an advocacy day for families and young children on May 15th. But it was the children who gathered to hear Senator John Cronin and Rep. Meg Kilcoyne read about a mouse, a strawberry, and a big hungry bear that had everyone captivated. School Superintendent Steve Meyer introduced the program, saying programs like this are intended to fill the gap of early literacy, and if we fill it early, we are better off. The program supports students and supports families to support their students, Meyer said. Regina Rondina, the CECRC director, gave a history of the program from the initial state grant that funded the founding and its beginning house at the Bigelow Free Public Library to the Parker School, to the Church of the Good Shepherd, and finally its current home in what is now the Administration Building, formerly the Clinton Elementary School, and prior to that, St. John's School. Rondini described their program as having a preschool classroom and the former auditorium now designed as a children's gym, which is meant to be an active place to help children up to age 6 and their parents learn and grow together. The program offers different play areas and access to lending library of over 2,000 resources. Each month, we have 180 adults and 225 children participate, including diverse ethnic and economic backgrounds, mostly mothers, young children, fathers, grannies, and nannies, as well as early intervention specialists, she said. Mother Maxine Bizzazzo explored her history with the center, where her 5 children came to learn and explore. She attended parenting classes and eventually helped other parents, Bazaza said. She said the center has made a positive change in the community. It taught me to play with the children in ways that foster learning and education, while emphasizing positive parenting skills. She said it has helped her fill the relationship bucket with her children. Bazaza said she brought her daughter to the center 10 years ago, when she was about 2, and they were playing on the roller coaster. And she said she was helping too much until Rondina stepped in to teach her a better way to allow her daughter to learn how to use the toy on her own. My eyes were opened that I could expect more from my children, Bizzazzo said. They could be confident and proud, and in that moment I was confident and proud. Kilcoyne and Cronin talked about the work of the legislature and how it translates to programs like the CECRC. We get to see firsthand the votes we take, and the effects on families, Kilcoyne said. We hear literacy rates are dropping across the country, Kilcoyne said, adding that in Clinton, families are served well by the CECRC and the services provided. Cronin talked about a child's earliest years being foundational, helping children develop language skills, curiosity, and social and emotional learning. When the Senate takes up the budget, Cronin said he will be voting yes on the $12 million in funding that includes the CECRC. Early education and literacy helps the state invest in the next generation of students and workers, he said. Neshoba celebrates literacy grant even as funding threatened by Jan Gutzman, Bolton. The good news is that Neshoba was chosen last year as one of the state's 4 districts to serve as PRISM 1 focus districts to address early literacy. The bad news, the Neshoba Regional School District was told at their meeting on May 13th, is that while they have just finished the first of a 3-year PRISM program, the House and Senate did not include funding in their budget proposals. The PRISM 1 early literacy program is meant to address literacy deficits, especially in the year after COVID, by bringing intense programs to younger learners that they will hopefully bring forward throughout their schooling. Assistant Superintendent Laura Friend said that recently Senator Robin Kennedy and Rep. Megan Kilcoyne visited the district and toured kindergarten, first, and second grade classrooms. During their visits, legislators saw structured literacy instruction happening in our classrooms, she told the committee. Downing said the literacy launch initially got a $25 million budget, but during the deliberations with the House and Senate, the number was reduced to zero. He said Kennedy signed on to an amendment to reinstate money for this literacy launch. If the funding is not restored, we will have to discontinue the program or find a way to fund it within our budget, Downing said. The meeting was the last in-person meeting for 2-year student representative Ryan Metro and 3 members of the school committee who did not run for re-election, John McFarland of Stowe, Amy Cohen of Bolton, who was not present, and Jackie Reinhardt of Lancaster. All were honored with gifts given by Chair Leah Vivitrio. Stag softball ready for postseason play by Bill Marsh, Boylston. With the regular season winding down, the Tohonto Regional High School softball team is ready to make another strong run in the postseason. As of press time, the Stags own a 9-7 overall record and are 7-4 in the Midland Wachusett League D Division. Last season, Tohonto advanced to the MIAA Division 5 D5 statewide tournament round of 16. 2 years ago, the Stags made it all the way to the Final Four. In the recent power rankings this season, Tohonto is in 7th place, with the top 32 teams qualifying for the playoffs. The Stags coach, Steve Pacheco, who is retiring from teaching and coaching at the school, has been the softball head mentor for 26 years. We have a young team in many places, but there's a lot of potential with this team, Pacheco said. We have a lot of raw talent, and they are learning every day. We've been successful, but we are looking to get better for the state's tournament, he said. They're a great group to work with, and they work hard. The team's captains are seniors Molly Abdellah, Alyssa Schaefer, and Bella Wetherill, and junior Anna Bigdinger. In fast pitch softball, pitching is the name of the game, and Abdellah is the ace of the staff. Molly Abdellah is an inspirational leader and our ace, Pacheco said. She has an array of pitches and throws at a good velocity. She's really improved from last year and is our top pitcher, he said. Schaefer is the first baseman, while Witherwell is the left fielder. Alyssa Schaefer was a good player last year, but has taken a huge leap this year, both on offense and defense, Pacheco said. She's among the league leaders in hitting and is batting over .500. She plays a real good first base and has made some spectacular plays for us in the field, he added. Bella Wetherill is our starting left fielder, Pacheco said. She's a good hitter and a very good outfielder. She is fundamentally sound with a good arm, he said. She's a great at supporting her teammates, especially when things are getting tough, and just a great captain. Bingner is the catcher. Anna is one of the better catchers we've ever had, Pacheco said. She's been on the team since the 7th grade and is now a junior. She's hitting over .500 and plays almost every inning behind the plate, he said. She calls the games and is an elite catcher. She's an all-around outstanding player. Junior Layla Chahede plays second base, while 8th grader Catherine Tremeling is the shortstop. Freshman Stella Lewis is the third baseman. Layla is quick on the bases and she can play either second or short, Pacheco said. She's got a good range at second base and has a solid bat. Catherine Tremeling is our leadoff hitter, and she's batting over .400, he said. She has elite speed and is a very hard worker. She wants to get better at every practice and every game. Stella Lewis can hit the fastest of the fastest pitchers, Pacheco added. She makes good contact and almost never strikes out. She bats in the middle of the lineup and is batting at about 300. She had a strong arm at third and has a very bright future, he added. Tejanto has plenty of speed in the outfield with Wetherill in left, her sister Addison in center, and Olivia Quam in right. Addie has very good range in center and can hit the ball for power, Pacheco said. With her, we have another freshman in the lineup, and she's getting better with every practice and game. It's only the second year for Olivia Quam, and she's played softball, and she's batting 300, he said. She has speed and very good footwork in the outfield and gets to the balls and that are hit in her area. Other members of the squad are junior Lauren Ackerlane, sophomores Jaden Atkinson, Leah Joseph, Avery Gendron, and Sarah Joseph, and eighth grader Riley Durant. Ackerlane plays the infield, while Atkinson is the number two pitcher and designated hitter. Lauren does all the little things, whether it's in practice or the games, Pacheco said. She is the first one to practice and is great, great, great teammate. Jaden Atkinson is batting over 300, he said. She has some pop in her bat and has given us some innings on the mound. Leah Joseph plays both the infield and outfield, while Grendron is in the outfield. Leah is one of our runners, and she's a tenacious player, Pacheco said. It's the first time in a long time that Avery has played softball, but she's a great athlete with tremendous speed. She has developed skills at the plate and in the outfield very quickly. Sarah Joseph is an outfielder, with Durant plays the infield. Sarah has a great desire to get better at softball, Pacheco said. She's another good contact hitter at the plate and has great knowledge of the game. Riley has really come into her own, he said. She's getting into more games and is batting over 400 and has great power. The junior varsity middle school coach is Rebecca Cox. Stranger but true, yes, Clinton's acre did really stink, by Terrence Ingano. Stranger but true. Special to the item. First of all, I want everyone to know that I grew up on the acre, and it does not stink, despite what the Greeley Hill boys might think. However, I must admit that there was that summer in 1910 when an acre neighborhood really did stink, and it caused quite a stink among the neighbors of Chase, Webster, and Francis Streets. In June and July of 1910, three neighbors in the Webster Street area could no longer take the stench that was constantly in the air up there. No matter how you look at it, you can never get accustomed to the dreaded dead horse smell. Botzer Hainold of 25 Webster Street, Carl Kieger, sometimes spelled Kiegler, of 32 Webster Street, and John Kunst of Francis Street, called at the Clinton police station and swore out a complaint against one Joseph Spelvogel of 207 Chase Street. Apparently, Spelvogel had killed a horse and buried it improperly in his backyard. Chief of Police Sanderson had trouble believing the stench could be that bad, but decided to go up and find out for himself just how bad it might be. Accompanied by the complainants and two local newspaper reporters, Walter O'Toole and E.S. Irwin, Sanderson visited the Chase Street home. The odor around the entire neighborhood was almost unbearable, and Spelvogel demanded to know what the chief wanted. Sanderson requested to see where the dead horse was buried. Spelvogel must have been quite a talker because he gave long explanations as to why and how the horse was shot and how it was buried. After walking all around the property and wasting plenty of time, the group finally came across a grave only about 4 inches deep that gave forth a stench that truly was unbelievable. It was located about 300 feet from the home of Kunst and about the same distance from Webster Street. The dead horse was lying in a hole in a cramped position. Its nose was about 6 inches from the top of the ground and the forelegs straight up in the air. A neat pile of dirt was beside it. Spelvogel explained that the grave was properly covered, a week before, but that dogs must have dug it up. Sanderson sarcastically agreed that, yet, dogs on the acre must be very intelligent, as when they dig up dead animals, they put the dirt in one very neat pile. One of the reporters certainly had a gift for writing. Gentle Seffries, blowing along Webster Street last night, gathered up a greater amount of dead horse odor than the olfactory organs of many of the residents of that street could reasonably be expected to endure. Asked how many horses were actually buried in the trench, Spelvogel said only one was buried there, but he couldn't quite account for the fact that there were more jawbones in the graves than are usually found in one horse. The next day, all parties involved were facing Judge Jonathan Smith. Chief Sanderson was the first witness, followed by the local reporters and complainants. Another neighbor came forward to say she saw Spelvogel kill the horse on a Thursday, remove the hide on a Friday, and bury it on a Saturday. Attorney Charles Mayberry, representing Spelvogel, severely criticized the methods the police chief used in this case as to demanding to see where the horse was buried without a search warrant or formal complaint issued by the court. Judge Smith was having none of it, and Spelvogel was found guilty of violating a town bylaw and fined $15. And that, my friends, was the last time the acre ever stunk. Terence Engano is a local Clinton historian. His volumes of columns can be purchased at the Holder Memorial, home of the Clinton Historical Society, every Saturday. Proceeds benefit the item appeal. Summer concerts planned for towns. Music will give rhythm to the region as several summer concerts series are held. Here's a listing of those received by the item. Berlin, 19 Cotter Street Community Center has 8 summer concerts set for Saturdays between June 20th and August 15th, excluding July 4th, at the facility. Tickets are available now at 19carter.org. $175 for a complete summer pass. Individual tickets are $25 in advance or $30 at the door, $5 for students and free for children. 19 Carter will partner with local breweries and wineries at select concerts. June 20th, Southern Rail. July 27th, Swing 440. July 11th, Crocodile River Music. July 18th, Moe Dixon with Seth Asir and Gary Brown. July 25th, Nolan Slate Sextet. August 1st, Mark Russell and Friends. August 8th, Rio Flow Trio. And August 15th, Lori Diamond and Fred Uptelli with Analessi. For information, visit 19carter.org or email info@19carter.org. Clinton. Concerts are held every Tuesday in Central Park with rain date of Wednesday. Vendors expected include The Taco Dude, Sterling Street Brewery, The Fountain, Wheat and Water, and Fran Flynn. The host is Clinton Parks and Rec. Here's the schedule. June 16th, Fistful of Karma. June 23rd, Mr. Strickland. June 30th, Rogue Echoes. July 7th, Mike Mazzalo. July 14th, Michael Trangoni. July 21st, Lacquerhead. July 28th, Rampage Trio. August 4th, Brookfield Rhythm. August 11th, Crossroads Band. August 18th, 01510 Band. And on August 25th, the Rusty Buckets Band. Lancaster. Thayer Memorial Library's annual concert series is set for Thursday on July 9th, 16th, 23rd, and 30th, 6:30 p.m. July 9th, 16th, and 30th is in the reference room, and July 23rd is on the town green. Here's the schedule. July 9th, Outrageous Fortune. July 16th, Hungry Town. July 23rd, Hit the Bus Band. July 30th, Blue Collar Ramblers. Sterling. Sterling Recreation hosts concerts every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., June through August, in Memorial Park, behind the fire station. June 3rd, The Vig. June 17th, The Rock Blood Cazers. June 24th, Band from UNCLE Uncle. July 1st, Jim Atkinson Band. July 8th, Houston Bernard. July 15th, Slowgrass. July 22nd, Rusty Buckets. July 29th, Illusions. August 5th, Rampage Trio. August 12th, Rhythm. August 19th, P.T. Pickers. August 26th, Rose Gold Glasses. If you have a town summer concert series in the item that's not listed, hey, email information to news@clintonitem.com. There's a new dog in town, ready to work, Clinton. The Clinton Public Schools has a new employee, and everyone is wagging their tails in anticipation. Millie Mile will be joining Clinton Elementary School as a facility dog. Emma Mayo, Clinton Elementary Guidance Counselor, will serve as Millie's primary handler. Boonfield Labradors partnered with Clinton Elementary School in this opportunity. Peggy Brogan and David Brogan are the owners of Boonfield Labradors, where they breed and raise facility dogs. Their dogs are placed in schools or police departments, fire departments, nursing homes, and courthouses. Clinton PTA sponsored this opportunity for Clinton Elementary School. Millie will begin her training at Clinton Elementary School in early June and will officially become an employee in training starting next school year. Her primary role will be to foster a sense of belonging within the school community while supporting students' social, emotional regulation, and well-being. The school experienced tremendous success with our former therapy dog, Maggie McNally, and we're excited to welcome Millie into this important role following Maggie's retirement, the Clinton Public Schools stated in a press release. Clinton Schools Celebrate Retirees by Jan Gottsman. It was a celebration capped by school-produced and bright green and gold cupcakes at the Clinton School Committee as they honored retirees and departing school committee members at the May 18th meeting. Brendan Bailey has served on the school committee for 9 years, choosing instead of running for re-election to run for a seat on the select board. Superintendent Stephen Meyer called Bailey a gentleman. School committee member Bill Conley Jr. thanked him for his guidance in putting up with me here. Board member Tina Zabantis said she appreciated his common sense approach, and members Matt Verkaris and Jane Fitzgerald thanked him for his service. Bailey said he enjoyed his time and appreciated everyone he served with. Despite coming from a family of educators, including his father, a former Clinton superintendent, Bailey said he couldn't do what teachers and the schools do and thanked everyone involved. When I started, Joel Bates was chair and I couldn't ask for a better mentor, adding that he remembers his comment that we do policy, not procedure. Clinton Elementary School. The retiree from Clinton Elementary School, Donna McGowan, retired earlier in the year after serving as a kindergarten instructional assistant for 25 years. While McGowan could not attend the meeting, Principal Megan Frisch honored her. I've heard this saying, teaching is a work of heart. Donna truly worked in the best interest of students. She was dedicated, consistent, and gave love and care in all the right places, Frisch said. She had some of our tiniest students, but Mrs. McGowan will be that kind of adult they remember. She treated each student with the right balance of love and letting go to ensure they'd become strong, independent learners, reaching their potential. Frisch said McGowan's absence since her retirement earlier this year has been felt by the team. Donna has moved on to the life of no more glue sticks, no more spilled milk, no more mystery coughs. She worked hard and now can enjoy her beautiful grandchildren and hopefully lots of time in her garden. So Donna, cheers for moving from crayons to carefree days, Frisch said, inviting McGowan and all the retirees to return as substitutes in the school. Middle school principal Robert Seed was honored for his impact on the Clinton Public Schools community. Which Principal Tyler Steffi wrote stretches far beyond classroom schedules or job titles. Steffi could not be at the meeting, but Superintendent Stephen Meyer, who started at the same time as Seed, stood in and read Steffi's tribute. Mr. Seed's professional journey began in industry, but thankfully For generations of students and families, he eventually wisened up and found his true calling in middle school education, Steffi wrote. He started his career teaching math, but that quickly became a lifetime of leadership and service. Over the years, he wore many hats at Clinton Middle School: teacher, leader, department leader, union leader, and ultimately assistant principal, always bringing intelligence and perspective, humility, and unwavering care to every role he held. Steffi said that what makes Seed special is not just the length of his service, but the depth of his impact. His influence is generational. Former students now return as parents, sharing stories of the teacher or administrator who believed in them, challenged them, studied them, and helped shape who they became. Families trusted him. Colleagues leaned on him. Students respected him because they knew exactly what they would get every day: fairness, accountability, consistency, and genuine care. In a profession that can often feel chaotic, Mr. C was remarkably even-keeled. The calm voice, the quick smile, the steady presence in the room. He understood that middle school students need adults who can balance high expectations with humanity, and he modeled that balance beautifully throughout his career. The other retiree from the middle school is instructional assistant Kristen Kogan, who Steffi wrote has a tremendous impact on the students and staff. Kristen has always had a special ability to connect with kids, building relationships rooted in kindness and trust and genuine care. Students knew she was someone who would always put their needs first and support them however she could, Steffi wrote. Kristen also embodied what it means to be a true team player. She was always willing to step in wherever needed, quietly doing whatever was best for students and for the school community as a whole. Her flexibility, compassion, and dedication made a lasting difference in the lives of countless students and colleagues, he wrote. Clinton High School. High school principal Scott Zemirk honored his school retirees. He honored Michelle Elliott, who earned her Spanish degree from UMass Amherst and studied in Spain before working there for a few years. She began her teaching career in Leominster, where she taught for 8 years before joining CHS, where she has taught for the past 11 years. Over her 20 years in the classroom, Michelle taught Spanish levels 1 through 4 and is known for her enthusiasm, innovative teaching methods, and genuine care for her students, Sir Mark said, adding that Elliot took time to raise her children before returning to the classroom. Blanca Brusso was honored for 37 years of service to Clinton. She started in Clinton as a paraprofessional before earning her degrees from AUC. Over her 37 years, she taught bilingual education and ESL across every grade and adult education in all three buildings, and served as both EL department chair at CHS and EL coordinator for the Clinton district. Blanca describes herself as empathetic, loving, and dedicated, and she spent her career paying forward the kindness shown to her by the mentors who guided her early on, Sersmack said. Tobias Crawley's retirement after 33 years of service was bittersweet, Sermick said. They went to high school together, and for the past 32 years, I've had the privilege of working alongside him and watching him shape the lives of students in ways that will last a lifetime. Crawley has taught woodworking, metal fabrication, Spanish, physical education, and social studies, while also chaperoning nature's classroom and school dances, Sermack said. Crawley began at CHS when it opened its doors in 1998 and built an impressive roster of courses, including furniture production, construction technology, graphic arts, black and white photography, and engineering the future. With his construction technology, students leaving a lasting mark on this very building, Toby. Thank you for 33 years of hard work, dedication, and friendship. Enjoy the open water and the next great chapter ahead, Sersmack said. Neshoba DECA team has record-breaking season. Submitted by Neshoba DECA DECA. Atlanta. Neshoba DECA students had the most successful international conference in the program history, according to Stavros Andropoulos and Kate Norton, the Neshoba advisors. The Neshoba squad competed at the DECA International Career Development Conference alongside more than 26,000 students from across the United States and 7 countries. Thanks to the hard work of our students and the support of our community, Neshoba DECA had the most successful international conference in program history, the advisors wrote in a letter to supporters. For the first time ever, Neshoba DECA brought home an international championship glass trophy. Dulce Cristal Dubois and Odella Brzanskis earned first place in the hospitality and tourism operations research. Other students scoring high at the event were Ryan Carr, fifth place in the world for community giving campaign, and Zane Khan and Malik Shanak, top 15 in the world for their independent business plan. In total, 22 Neshoba students represented our school on the international stage with professionalism, confidence, and pride, the advisor wrote. We truly could not achieve this level of success without the support of our families and volunteers, judges, and community members. Your willingness to help at mock competitions and provide feedback, volunteer your time, and encourage our students plays a major role in preparing them for moments like these. Andropoulos and Norton offered special thanks to gold-level sponsors, Clinton Savings Bank and Aligned Credit Union, and the rest of our partners for supporting our 270-member team this year. Reflections, Time to Step Forward and Step Up by Jan Kotzman, Item Editor. Why get involved? One person can't make a difference. I hear this a lot, but I see so many people who do get involved, who give of themselves, and we keep losing a whole generation of them. I don't think I have room to mention them all if I cleared out the rest of the paper, so I will talk about just 3 people who never hesitated to get involved and will leave a huge gap that someone has to fill. How about you? John Jack Graves is the perfect example. He was one of those people who could always be counted on to volunteer wherever needed in Clinton. Jack, I don't remember ever hearing him referred to as John. He was part of the community. He was Jack. He was a longtime Clinton Call firefighter, board member of the Clinton Historical Society, Clinton Holiday Pops Committee, and former Clinton Home for the Aged. At St. John, the guardian of Our Lady Parish, he served on the Church Restoration Committee. Jack was honored by the Clinton Area Chamber of Commerce as Man of the Year in 2000, but like so many who stepped forward, he didn't do it for the accolades. He did it because he never said, "Why should I get involved?" Instead, he said, "Why not me?" There's so much more that could be said, but if you knew Jack, you could say it better than I could. His service was held last week. Next was Jim Emerton, a longtime Sterling firefighter, EMT, who died last week from occupational cancer. Jim was one of those who ran into danger when the rest of us ran away, and he always seemed to have a big smile on his face. He joined the Sterling Fire Department in October of 2009, and after a career in literature publishing, found a passion for community service and emergency management after volunteering with the Area Community Emergency Response Team, known as CERT, according to a post from the Sterling Fire Department. He became an EMT, the paramedic, and then he was dedicating his life to helping others. The Sterling Fire Facebook pages said he had a solution for every problem, all while cracking corny dad jokes. In his obituary, it states, his greatest honor was tending to members of the community when they needed it the most. He never once saw the call for service and said, "Why me?" He just jumped in to help. Services for Jim Emerton are going to be on Saturday, May 30th at 11 a.m. at Hope Chapel. There will be a procession that runs from Miles Funeral Home through the center of town to Hope Chapel prior to the services. The third loss to the region is someone many might not know, but I don't want it to go by without at least a mention. Paul Mina was head of the United Way of Tri-County, which Wheat Community Services here in Clinton is part of. Through his leadership, compassion, and unwavering commitment to helping others, Paul dedicated his life to strengthening communities and improving the lives of individuals and families across the Commonwealth, the organization noted in the official notification, adding, he championed collaboration and innovation and service, helping to expand programs and partnership that provided critical support to those in need. Again, someone who stepped forward. And every time we lose one of these people, someone else needs to step forward to fill that void. Someone who says, it is my time. I can make a difference. Why not me? So why not you? Jan Gottsman is editor of The Item. She can be reached at news@clintonitem.com. Want a Dunkin' iced coffee bucket when they launch? Each store has just 25 by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, New England. Need a pick-me-up? You'll soon officially be able to buy a 48-ounce bucket full of Dunkin' iced coffee. The Canton-based chain said it will sell a limited amount of iced beverage buckets at stores nationwide on Friday, May 22nd, to kick off Memorial Day weekend. Earlier this year, Dunkin' tested the drink tubs at select locations in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and word quickly got around. Social media users who discovered the test stores began posting videos of the mammoth bucket of Joe on Instagram and TikTok. A Dunkin' spokesperson said the response to the testing phase was overwhelmingly positive, prompting the company to officially launch the viral drink buckets. The 48-ounce buckets are 16 ounces larger than Dunkin's current large cups and hold roughly the same amount of liquid as a large and a small cup combined. Here's what to know about the limited run of Dunkin' iced coffee buckets. How much do the Dunkin' iced coffee buckets cost and where to buy? The 48-ounce Dunkin' iced beverage buckets cost $12.99 each and can be filled with either iced coffee or refresher, the company said. The drinks are also fully customizable, so customers can choose their flavors, caffeine levels, and sweetness. They will be sold at stores nationwide, Dunkin' said. How many Dunkin' iced coffee buckets will be sold at each store? The chain is bringing them to Dunkin' stores nationwide for a limited run on Friday, May 22nd, and each location will have a total of 25 iced buckets for sale, the spokesperson said. This likely means customers will need to visit early in the morning to snag one while they last. Customers can find the opening hours of their local Dunkin' stores on their website. The Dunkin' bucket launch comes months after Starbucks released its limited edition barista cold cups, which saw strong demand and sold out quickly. All That Remains, Headlines Show at Palladium by Meg Trigallo, Worcester Magazine. In the 1990s, long before Springfield metal band All That Remains got together, lead singer Phil Labonte would make the hour-long drive east to Worcester to see shows at the Palladium. The Palladium, for a long time, was the only place where you could get a lot of types of bands we listened to, Labonte said. It's a long drive to go down to New York to catch a show. So when they would end up hitting the Palladium, we would go see a ton of bands. I saw Linkin Park, I saw Emperor, I saw Arch Enemy. I've seen so many bands that made such a massive impact on me, so that's the staple venue in my career. In the decades since, All That Remains has played the Palladium several times in several ways, from the main stage to the Palladium upstairs, as openers and as headliners, and they will return once again as the main event on May 23rd. A Song Catches Fire. They will be joined by special guests Born of Osiris and Dead Eyes, and there are six more bands on the bill, Led to Believe, Infinity Sequence, 656, Take the Flame, Christoporidarium, and Among Ghosts. Doors will open at 5 p.m., and the music starts at 5:30 p.m. The band's current tour is the first time fans have seen them play material from their most recent album, Antifragile, which they released more than a year ago in early 2025. And Labonte said the new material is going over well in a live setting. The kids are really moving around. People know the words and sing along. All the things you would hope for in a reaction to a song, we're getting, Labonte said. The band's previous album, Before Antifragile, came out in 2018, and Labonte said with several lineup changes in 7 years, including the death of guitarist Ole Herbert, he and his bandmates wanted to make a record that all that remains fans would like. Some people might say that's a very broad thing, because in our 25-year career, we've done a lot of different styles of stuff, Labonte said. We've covered a lot of ground and not let ourselves get pigeonholed into one style. This record is for the core, All That Remains fans, to put our stamp back on the 2000s metalcore title and say we're still the same band. Still a ton of people coming to the shows. In late summer 2024, All That Remains joined Mudvayne and Megadeth on tour, playing a handful of singles that would later come out on Antifragile as part of their opening set. And their current tour is the first time they've hit the road since. We put the record out and things didn't line up the way we wanted to with touring and other projects we had going. So unfortunately, we didn't get to go out, Labonte said. There's still a ton of people coming to the shows and an appetite to hear us play. It's really humbling, to be honest, to be so selective with what we do. And then when we go out on tour, people are still coming out. On the current 18-date U.S. tour, the band's headlining set contains a few songs from Antifragile, including the album Cut Their Tongues Out, among a range of songs from almost every album they've released in a career that has lasted more than 25 years. We're playing for over an hour, and we want to make sure that the songs people, we want to play songs that people really want to hear. We're playing, Labonte said. The people that keep showing up over and over, those are the people who make it so we can do this. And we want them to walk away feeling they got what they came for. Above all, Labonte said, it's a thrill to return to the Palladium, where he so often watched from the audience and now gets to see hundreds of fans from the stage. We've been playing that venue for so long that 25 years later, we still see a lot of the same people, Labonte said. They were young teens the first time they came out, and now they're adults, but they're still down in front singing along. And that's really incredible, to keep coming back year after year and still see the same people coming out and supporting you. All That Remains, with special guests Born of Osiris and Dead Eyes, 5:30 p.m. on May 23rd at the Palladium, 261 Main Street in Worcester, $41 and up, thepalladium.net. Massport to unveil 45-foot soccer ball near Boston Harbor in June by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, New England. A 45-foot soccer ball with a $300,000 price tag will soon be inflated at the edge of Boston Harbor. Yes, you read that right. The Massachusetts Port Authority plans to attempt a Guinness World Record title for the world's largest soccer ball in celebration of the upcoming 2026 FIFA World Cup. The previous record of 38 feet, 11.8 inches, was set in Doha, Qatar in February of 2013. After construction is wrapped up in Ohio, the ball will be shipped to Piers Park 2 in East Boston just in time for the first match at Gillette Stadium. The spectacle will be visible from across the harbor. Bringing this iconic display to East Boston gives people the opportunity to come together, enjoy the neighborhood's vibrant waterfront and skyline views, and share in the excitement of the FIFA World Cup, Massport CEO Rich Davey said in a statement. The ball, which will weigh approximately 2,200 pounds, is made of material similar to a standard soccer ball, according to Massport spokesperson Samantha Decker. Its inner bladder is made of PVC-coated polyester fabric, while the outer layer is 1.2 millimeter thick polyurethane leather. This will be more than 19 times the size of the ball used in FIFA-sanctioned games, which are between 27 to 28 inches. Those soccer balls weigh between 14 and 16 ounces, less than a pound. The $300 cost is being split equally between Massport and corporate sponsors, including engineering consultant HNTB, she said. Guinness World Records will officially measure the ball in Ohio this week, Decker said. The bright blue 45-foot soccer ball will be on display at Piers Park 2 in East Boston from June 12th through June 18th. A community celebration featuring family-friendly activities and entertainment is also scheduled for Saturday, June 13th from 12 to 4 p.m. at the park. In closing, this community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Ellen. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have your best day ever.